Okay, so imagine a city layout as basically a rigged board game. Like, if you're a nation that's decades into democracy now, how do you actually fix apartheid geography when the rules were, poured right into the concrete?
Yeah, that is, it's really the ultimate urban planning challenge right there. Because, I mean, those historical rules weren't just about where people lived,
Right.
they were about systematically limiting access to opportunity.
Exactly. And so today we are doing a deep dive into this 2014 South African spatial planning framework. Our mission here is to understand how physical geography intentionally shapes societal inequality and, how a government actually goes about rewiring it.
It's a massive undertaking.
It really is. And looking at this framework, there's this one point that feels totally counterintuitive to me. It says that early post-apartheid efforts to build low-income housing actually made the spatial distortions worse.
Yeah, they really did.
Which is wild because they were building homes, but putting them on the extreme geographic periphery. I mean, why would the physical location of a house be more critical than just getting people a solid roof over their heads?
Well, because poverty isn't just a lack of money, it is a spatial lack of access.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the framework points out that the distances between home and work just absolutely crush the disposable income of the poorest citizens.
Right, like the commute itself.
Exactly. If you build a house 50 miles from economic centers, you haven't really solved poverty. You've basically just traded a housing crisis for, well, a transportation and mobility crisis.
So the commute essentially acts as a tax on the poor.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, so the only way to fix that spatial gap is to somehow shrink the space itself, right? And here is where it gets really interesting. The framework gives this highly specific blueprint. It says it takes exactly 60 dwelling units per hectare to make public transport viable.
Yes, 60.
Like, why exactly 60? What happens if you only have, say, 40?
It really just boils down to critical mass. Think of a public transit system like a restaurant, you know.
Okay.
If you don't turn over enough tables every hour, the business goes bankrupt.
Right, makes sense.
So to make a bus or train line economically viable, you need a strict minimum density of riders living within walking distance of the stops.
And 60 is that magic number.
60 units per hectare is that tipping point, yeah.
Yeah.
If you picture your own neighborhood, unless you're living in a mid-rise apartment complex or like tightly packed townhomes, you probably aren't hitting that number.
Okay, but a government can't just mandate that everyone suddenly move into mid-rises.
No, definitely not.
So how do they actually force that kind of density to happen in the real world?
Well, they use what the framework calls catalytic projects. These are major developments deliberately dropped within a one-hour commute of existing economic hubs.
Oh, so not just out in the middle of nowhere.
Right. The idea isn't just to build houses, it is to plant an economic anchor, like maybe a new transit hub or a mixed-use commercial zone.
Something that draws people in.
Exactly. Something that naturally pulls in private investment and dense housing around it.
Wait, I want to challenge that for a second. Because the framework says they target areas of deprivation to decide where to spend money. Doesn't that just mean building in the exact same poor, isolated areas we just established was a terrible idea?
You would think so, but that is the genius of how they use map overlays. They don't just look at deprivation in a vacuum.
Oh, okay.
Planners actually take a map of investment potential, showing where the jobs and infrastructure already are,
Right.
and they overlay it directly on top of the areas of deprivation.
Ah, so they are basically looking for the Venn diagram overlap.
Precisely. They target specific nodes, like, say, a historic mining town that has existing infrastructure, but also high poverty.
Got it.
By injecting a catalytic project right there, a single development can trigger massive incremental growth. It stitches that fractured, segregated part of the city back into the main economic engine.
And they are really racing against the clock here. The framework notes this massive demographic shift, projecting like 70% urbanization by the year 2030.
It is a huge influx.
Yeah, and to handle that, they aim for a 70 to 30 ratio of rental to ownership in subsidized housing.
Which is a big shift.
Right, because why prioritize rentals so heavily when home ownership is usually seen as, the holy grail of wealth building?
Well, because rapid urbanization brings highly mobile populations. People migrating to cities for work need flexibility.
Not a 30-year mortgage tying them down.
Exactly. If the government only builds homes to own, it severely slows down labor mobility.
Makes sense.
Providing massive rental stock allows people to quickly move closer to where the new jobs are popping up. which feeds right back into creating that transit density we talked about.
It is just a complete rewiring of the physical machine of the city. And it really makes you look at your own daily reality differently. You know, just look at who has a brutal 2-hour commute in your own city and who gets to simply walk to work.
Absolutely. I mean, the built environment is never neutral. It always reflects a specific set of priorities.
Even if those priorities were set decades before you moved in.
Exactly.
So think about that rigged board game we started with. If a nation's historic inequality can be so meticulously mapped out and restructured through physical urban design, how might the seemingly boring zoning laws in your own neighborhood be quietly engineering who gets to succeed in your community?